Sports Business Radio launched in 2004, Ryan Berger has interviewed the biggest names in sports and business. Let's step into the Sports Business Radio vault and look back on some of our favorite conversations. This week, we look back on conversations with golf legend Jack Nicklaus and late NBA Commissioner David Stern. Now, enter the Sports Business Radio vault.
One-on-one with those making the big-time decisions that impact your sport. This is Sports Sense on Sports Business Radio. Sports Business Radio.
My guest is Jack Nicklaus. He's the winner of a record 18 major championships. He's the CEO of the Nicklaus Company and a goodwill ambassador for the game of golf. Mr. Nicklaus, it's an honor to have you on Sports Business Radio. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Brian.
So, I got to tell you, in doing my research for this interview, I was struck by what an amazingly busy schedule you keep. You just finished hosting the Memorial. You're the head of the Nicklaus Companies. You travel to dozens of countries every year designing courses for Nicklaus Design. And you somehow find time to spend quality time with your wife, your children, your 21 grandchildren. You seem to be working more now than you were when you were playing regularly. Where do you get all this energy?
Well, if I don't keep the energy up, you know, they put you away, and they farm you out or something, Brian. I don't know. I've always had energy. I've always been sort of one of those kids when I was growing up that I got up in the morning and I came in at night and my mom grabbed my ears, you know.
Right.
And but I've always had to be doing something. And I, you know, people always say, well, gosh, you know, how do you do all this stuff? And I said, well, you know, you got to remember, I was playing 25 weeks a year. I was traveling tournament golf and spending a week at a place. I don't do that anymore, and I've got 25 free weeks now.
Right.
And so I'm going to fill them. I enjoy filling them up and working and doing things, and it's, you know, most people work all their life to retire to play golf. I play golf all my life to retire to work.
Right.
And so I kind of enjoy that, and I've got the grandkids are growing up. My oldest just graduated from high school last week, and so I'm watching them with high school athletics, and I'll watch some of them with college and in the future. And so we're pretty active.
It's an exciting time for you, I'm sure. You're an incredible goodwill ambassador for the game of golf. You remain close to the United States Golf Association. As an endorsee of the Royal Bank of Scotland, you've entered into a deal that puts the USGA and the RBS together in a business relationship. The four-year agreement with the USGA features a number of components that will be integrated across all USGA championships, including the U.S. Open and the U.S. Women's Open. So now RBS has ties to three of golf's four majors, is the official patron sponsor of the British Open Championship and the PGA Championship. Can you explain this new partnership between the RBS and the UGA and what your role is going to be going forward?
Well, you know, the RBS has been involved with the British Open for over 100 years.
Right.
And they still are the Royal Bank of Scotland. They felt like Royal Bank of Scotland was a little bit restrictive since they became the I think the third largest bank in Europe, and now they're the fourth largest bank in the world or the sixth largest bank in the United States. And my role was to help them transition from the Royal Bank of Scotland to RBS. And they used me as that vehicle. And so through the advertising and promotion of my involvement with them, I think a lot of people realize that RBS is a pretty significant player in the United States today.
Absolutely.
And part of that has been all through the game of golf. So the natural relationship of being involved with the British Open, they wanted to expand that to be involved with golf's best, so they want to be involved with the USGA and the PGA and their championships also, and they are. And, you know, I'm sort of that vehicle to bring them together from the game of golf. And it's been a very nice relationship. It's been great for me, and I'm sure it's been great for RBS, or they wouldn't continue to have me.
Yeah, I'm sure. I love the commercials that they've done with you, too. I think those are great. You know, I look at what you've done and just what you've meant to the game of golf, not only when you played, but now you have Nicklaus Design. It's an incredibly successful golf course design company. You've designed courses in 45 countries around the world. There's 300 Nicklaus courses. You're designing 100 more. And between what you're doing with the USGA to promote the game of golf and these courses you're designing, what a legacy you're leaving for future golfers.
Well, you know, it's a game that gave me so much, and it's a game that I want to continue to be part of and continue to grow with it. One of the neat things about the things I'm doing is that You know, we're actually working in 29 new countries now, as well as all the other countries we've been working in.
Wow.
And, you know, we go into these countries, and a lot of them, we're the first golf course in that country.
That's got to be
fun. And to have the opportunity to form the shape of what that game is going to be in that country and its future is kind of fun to go into mostly Eastern Bloc now with this country, going into Russia, Poland, you know, Bulgaria, Ukraine, all the way down through Romania and Czech Republic, so forth and so on. All those are all new places. And, you know, they all will grow up now on a pretty decent golf course, and the young people that come from there will be able to compete around the world and make the game more of a global game, continue to grow it. And that's kind of fun to be part of that.
I've got to ask you a question as a designer. You're the greatest golfer who ever lived. So when you're designing a course, how do you put yourself in someone like my shoes? I'm a duffer. And when you're designing these holes, how do you think in terms of someone like me instead of Jack Nicklaus, greatest golfer who ever played?
Well, I think that we've done over 300 golf courses, so I think when you start to look at it, you pretty well figure out that who's going to play it. And, you know, only 1.8% of your play is played from the back tees. So you're really designing the golf course for 98.2% of the people. And so you really better be designing from the members' tees, because that's where your bread and butter comes from. And so you've got to figure out how does the average golfer hit it? How do the women hit it? How do juniors? How do beginners? You got to try to figure out how that's going to work, and you just keep working with it and try to play them around. I mean, some of the first golf courses I did were very difficult golf courses because they were done for tournament golf.
Right.
And you know, like Muirfield is a difficult golf course. Shoal Creek, Castle Pines, they're all done for tournament golf. Well, then all of a sudden I figured out. I said, you know, I'm really not designing this golf course for 1 week a year. I should be designing this golf course for 51 weeks a year.
Right.
And adapting it to a tournament. I think if I look back at Augusta, I think Augusta is a wonderful golf course. It's a wonderful members golf course. All they did was move the tees back and hide the pins, and they played the Masters. So that philosophy I've always thought has been pretty darn good. And, you know, it worked for the Masters and it's successful. Why not try to take it forward? So I try to look at that kind of a thing and when I'm designing. And I think it's been successful. We sometimes don't get it right every time, but a lot of times we do. And I think we've got a lot of people that have enjoyed our golf courses and enjoy playing them and living there. So it's been fun to be able to be part of it.
I would imagine that people find you. If someone wants to hire Jack Nicklaus to design their course, how does that process take place? I mean, I see your website, and obviously you've got a pristine reputation, but you know, these people in third bloc countries, Eastern bloc countries, how do they find you and bring you in to design their courses?
Well, they figure it out somehow. they get to us. And, you know, most of the stuff comes into the office, although I have an office in Moscow, and I got an office in Brussels. I got an office in Seoul, an office in Hong Kong, Beijing, South Africa. Representatives in Argentina, and I've got people in all parts of the world. And so, you know, we're doing golf courses in all parts of the world. So people generally figure out that, hey, Jack's doing a golf course in China. We ought to be able to figure out where is he doing China. We talk to those people. We're doing a golf course in Russia. How do we talk to those people over there if we want one in Bulgaria? You know, I mean, they figure out how to get to us otherwise, and our people are always prospecting. And frankly, you know, the Internet's been a great source of our business. I would say that 10 years ago we got, maybe 5% of our leads off of the Internet, and I'd say today we probably get 60-70% of our leads off the Internet.
Wow, that's amazing. I would have never guessed that.
I wouldn't have either, but it actually is a fact.
That's great. My guest is Jack Nicklaus. Mr. Nicklaus, there's lots of talk, obviously, about Tiger Woods eventually breaking your record of 18 major championships. Tiger sits at 13 right now as we speak. A remarkable stat that very few people realize is that you finished second 19 times out of the 162 majors you played in. So if you won half of those, you'd have 28 major championships. I think what Tiger's doing is incredible, but, I mean, let's be realistic here. If you had 28 majors, we wouldn't talk about Tiger breaking your record at all. Who faced the stiffer competition, you or Tiger? For my vote, you did.
Well, thank you. But first of all, I failed 19 times then. That's sort of the way I look at it, Brian. I mean, I got beat or I failed 19 times where I came close, and I won 18 times. So, but you know, you're going to lose sometimes when you're in contention, and you're going. And I think that the competition that I had, I think there it was very difficult. I mean, and the reason I think it was difficult is because we had fewer really good players, but the good players we had all learned how to win. And they'd all won 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 majors. You know, Arnold and Gary and Trevino and Watson. Those guys all knew how to win. And if I slipped up, they were ready to play. The problem today is that we have Tiger, and then we have so many other really really good players. But there's just not enough. They don't get enough exposure of winning to really feel confident coming down the stretch that they're going to make it happen. So I don't know really how to answer the question properly. There are probably more good players today, but yet ours had the experience to learn how to win. So you don't know really what is right.
We hear the story about a young Tiger taping a sheet with your stats on his bedroom wall and kind of being fixated on catching you someday. Who was the guy that you were maybe fixated on? Was it Arnold Palmer as you were growing up and you said, that's who I want to be, or that's who I want to break all of his records?
Well, Bobby Jones actually was. Bobby Jones won the U.S. Open at Scioto in 1926, and I grew up at Scioto. I started playing golf course in 1950, and there were many golfers that are members of that club that were there when Jones won, including my father. And so I never heard anything other but Jones, 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 and I never really thought anything about breaking any records. It was never. We didn't have that kind of pressure. Tigers had it on from day one, but I mean, it wasn't until 1970 and I won my 10th major. And I walked in the press room, and Bob Green of the AP said, Jack, that's 10 majors you've won now. Congratulations. You only got 3 more to tie Bobby Jones. I said, what? I mean, I'll be very honest with you, I had never counted them. I never even dreamed of it. Never even entered my mind. And I never thought Bobby Jones' 13 majors was approachable. And then all of a sudden, I was 3 away from it. Then I actually focused on it. And then when I focused on it, I got past it. And, I just played, tried to win what I could after that, but you pretty much, you know, once you pass something, you lose your drive to go on. Even though I wanted to play golf, I just didn't. I didn't drive as hard as I did when I was younger. But my record is what it is. I certainly wish. I'm quite happy with what it is. Do I wish it was more? Sure. Now I do.
Sure.
But how did I know Bob? How did I know Tiger Woods was going to come along? Or how did Bobby Jones know Jack Nicklaus was going to come along? You know, it really isn't. It really isn't important. Tiger is a great player. He's doing and dominating the game today. He's a nice young man. He handles himself well. The game's in good hands. So if he breaks my record, you know, more power to him. I just want to be the first one to shake his hand. And obviously nobody wants their records to be broken, but, you know, I think it brings more excitement into the game to have Tiger chasing my record. Obviously, it puts my name in the newspaper every day right beside his. So,
sure.
You know, it's not all that bad for me either. So, but it's kind of exciting. It's kind of fun to watch him play. He's a very, very talented young man and fun to watch.
One of the things that's so different, obviously, today is compared to when you played, the prize money. I mean, Tiger's made $93 million on the tour. You won 113 tournaments, and you earned a little bit less than $6 million in your entire career on the tour. Obviously, I would guess you're earning a lot more than that with Nicklaus Design and your other endeavors now, but do you ever look back and just go, gosh, I played in the wrong era. I could be making a lot more money now with 113 victories.
Well, I think Ben Hogan actually looked like he thought maybe he played in the wrong era.
Yeah, no kidding.
His total lifetime earnings were like $241,000.
Wow.
So, I mean, if you really look at that, I mean, it's just times change. And, you know, what I look at is I think that the kids today are really blessed. They have the opportunity to play golf for a living. And we played golf and had to be successful so we could go make a living. You know, I mean, with outside things, you never made a living on a golf course when we played.
Right.
And today the kids can actually play golf and don't have to do anything else. They can play golf and make a living. And I think that's neat. And we were the forerunners of that. We the group in front of us, the Hogans and the Nelsons and the Sneeds were the forerunners of that. And then we came in and then we were the ones that started to get it to the next level. And then Tiger and his group are taking it to the next level. And I think it's great for the game.
Jack, Father's Day is next weekend. All four of your sons work for you, and you won your last major in 1986, the Masters, with your son Jack carrying your bag for you. That had to have been a wonderful thrill. Talk about the wonderful bond that you've built with your sons. You know, honestly, I see a lot of athletes who play, and they're so involved in their athletic endeavors that their relationship with their family suffers. And I've got to tip my hat to you because you seem like you're so close with your family, and I think that's just so admirable.
Well, that's always been the most important thing in my life, Brian. My wife and I grew up in the Midwest in Ohio. We both have same values. We both felt like we both came from close families, and we both felt like family was the most important thing. And I probably could have won a lot more tournaments if I would have sort of been selfish enough to leave my family. But I just didn't want to do that. My family is what I wanted to be part of, and my kids are all working with me. They're all doing things that are similar to what I do. They're all trying to handle their kids the way I handle them, which makes me proud. I've got a good group of kids, and they're good citizens, and they do well. And I think that's what my wife and I are most proud of.
Right. I mean, it's such a wonderful trait and quality that you have, and think of all the generations that you've affected. Last question for you. Obviously, you've played the game of golf all your life. You've been there with golf during some incredibly joyous moments like we discussed with the 1986 Masters, but golf has been an outlet for you for some incredibly somber moments as well. What are the main lessons the game of golf can teach us if we pay close enough attention?
Well, I think the game is a game that you get out of it what you put into it. And you get, you develop relationships with people. I think you play 18 holes of golf with somebody. You get to know them pretty well.
You're exactly right.
Yeah, you know what kind of a sport they are. You know what kind of a personality they got. You know whether they're a hothead or whether they'll enjoy the game for the game, or they're driven by total competition, or they're driven for greed, or whatever they're driven by. And you find that out pretty quickly on the golf course. So it's a great game for that. It's a great game for people. It's a great game for a father to play with a son. It's a great game for a grandfather to play with his grandson or granddaughter. And, it can be played by all walks of life and people of all handicaps and all abilities. It's just a marvelous game. And there's not many games like that. So to be fortunate enough to be involved in that game all my life has been a very, very special thing for me. And it's you meet the same people on the way down that you meet on the way up, Brian. You know that. So you better watch your P's and Q's on the way up, because you're going to have to eat them on the way down if you haven't handled it right.
Well, it's great, great advice, and it's such an honor to speak with you. You've always conducted yourself in such a wonderful manner on and off the course, and I really wish you the best in all of your endeavors moving forward.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, too. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Now, here's Brian's conversation with the late NBA Commissioner David Stern from December 2016 at the Sports Business Radio Roadshow presented by Boingo Wireless in New York City. A conversation conducted in front of a studio audience.
Without further ado, we all know this gentleman. Let's give David Stern a big round of applause. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, always.
So the backstory with former Commissioner Stern and myself is that in 2004 we launched Sports Business Radio, and David was kind enough to be my first guest. He was just joking in the green room that he launched my career. So.
He hasn't let me go since. It's really impossible.
So let's start off by, we start these roadshows, we do them in front of students. Let's talk about when you were a student, if you can remember back to when you were a student.
That was before the
flood. I won't
give
out the years. But
no,
you went
no
to
problem.
Undergrad at Rutgers.
Correct.
And you...
I'm old that I remember we traveled down to Asbury Park, New Jersey to watch the Floyd Patterson-Sonny Liston fight.
Wow.
That lasted for something under 30 seconds, I think. Sonny just came out and decked him. And I just uncovered a yellowed paper where in the Asbury Park Sun, they asked my colleagues and I, colleagues, my fellow students and I, if we would stand up and cheer because they wanted to get a photo after the fight was completely over. And everyone looked at us like we were crazy. We're standing there cheering after this 30-second fight. So I was a sort of a, quote, sports fan back then.
But you were a history student, right, at Rutgers?
Well, you have to list a major.
Okay.
So the least intrusive was history and political science. So I was a history and poli-sci major.
And we've got students here from the Marist Center of Sports Communications, but we also have students here from Columbia Sports Management.
I'm going to ruin it all for you. I mean, we used to play crazy eights and sexy sixes, poker, gin, bridge. Not was later. No, I mean, I did okay in school, but I wasn't the most serious and applied student you ever saw.
So at what point did you gravitate to sports? Because you go from...
Well, I was always a sports fan. Okay. When I grew up in New York City, my dad, we lived on, actually close by, we lived on 18th Street and 9th.
Okay.
And then we moved uptown to 24th Street between 7th and 8th. And the garden was on 49th and 50th, the old garden. And if you went to school in New York, let's say junior high school, you got something called the GO card. I think it was government organization. And for 50 cents, you got tickets. You got into the garden on a Saturday afternoon. So I was a big Knicks fan, a big sports fan. I was a baseball Giant fan. I never set foot into Ebbets Field where the hated Dodgers were, although I did occasionally go to a Yankee game. It was in my small world. Rheingold was the sponsor of the Giants. Schaefer was the sponsor. Schaefer Beer was the sponsor of the Dodgers. And Ballantyne was the sponsor of the Yankees. And the Rheingold salesman was much nicer. And so I used to get tickets to the Polo Grounds when the Giants were playing there. I was a big Giants fan, a big Knicks fan. I didn't come to Giants football until later. And don't tell Gary Bettman this, but I really didn't grow up being interested in hockey either.
Okay, we won't tell him.
Okay.
So,
although he's a good friend, we've never had that discussion.
Uh-oh. We'll try and
keep
this
it down. Okay.
Information from him. You were outside general counsel for the NBA. How does that then lead?
That's it. Okay, so I graduated law school and went to work for a firm, Proskauer Rose. It's now the name of it. It used to be Proskauer Rose, Getz & Mendelsohn. And shortly after I joined it, or when I joined it, they had a client, the NBA. It was not a big client. Basically when the young associate, who was a year older than I was, left to go back to Philadelphia, where he was from, I went into the partner in charge and said, I had plenty of time and plenty of space to take over what he was doing. I would most charitably characterize that statement as not entirely truthful, since I was busy, but the opportunity to work in sports was like too compelling. And so I started working almost immediately in a case entitled Hawkins versus the NBA.
Connie Hawkins.
And I worked on that case seemingly day and night until it was settled. And then I began working on a variety of other cases. You know, when the ABA was formed, there were lawsuits between NBA teams and ABA teams. I was constantly litigating, and then I guess there was the Robertson versus NBA, our Players Association sued us. The ABA sued the NBA. And so between my colleagues and I, we were running around the country doing depositions and the like. And that case was set. Both cases were settled in 1976, and by 1978, I was spending my full time on NBA matters, having become a partner, I think, in 74. And then Larry O'Brien said, "Would you like to come over to the NBA?" Now, I don't know how to sort of set the scene here, but I was the 24th employee of the NBA in 1978.
So 24th, like in the history of the league, you were number 24.
Well, I was the 24th. There were 23 other employees. There were no. I was the first general counsel.
Okay.
I don't think we had someone in charge of basketball. I know that seems strange, but Cy Gourdin was sort of the deputy commissioner, a lawyer. He was sort of in charge of basketball. It was after I was there for a while that we hired, I can't remember, I think it was Joe Axelson, first general manager who came to work for the NBA as the head of basketball operations. It was a tiny, tiny place with a very small business. But frankly, I took the job only on the condition that the firm said I could come back after a couple of years, because I didn't want to, why are you laughing? What's up on the hashtag? Come on, share it with us. Okay. Why is this guy smiling?
I think they're just admiring their social media posts.
I see, okay. I was afraid that if someone else took the job, it would go to another firm and I wouldn't be working on the NBA anymore.
Okay.
Because I loved it. And in that role, because of Hawkins, because of the litigation, I got to meet everyone. I actually had to defend the deposition of Morris Podoloff, who was the first NBA commissioner. I actually looked at the constitution and bylaws of the NBA, the original one, which was a marked-up copy of the NHL's constitution, because the NBA was simply a league where hockey owners who owned buildings needed something else to put into their buildings. The college basketball was much bigger than professional basketball. Mm-hmm. And I guess at that time, I don't know how large the league was, but it wasn't, because the NBA, I think, was a 9-team league until the late 60s, when a whole slew of teams, it became a national league then. That's when Portland came in, Seattle came in, Houston. I think Houston started out in San Diego, but then moved to Houston or something like that. It was, there was a slew of teams as we grew into a national footprint for expansion prices, like of $1.7 million, I think, or $1.75 million was the Phoenix expansion price, which the owners bragged to me. They put a small down payment and they paid the rest with the advanced season ticket money. And then they stayed ahead of the curve. It was just absolutely hand to mouth at best.
Now, $24 billion is the TV deal for the NBA. The average franchise, according to Forbes, is $1.5 billion for the average NBA franchise. And David, when you've been on my show before, I think you pointed out the last time you were on, in 1978, the league was generating $78 million worth of revenue. Now it's $8 billion. And I've always said I've
It's gone up a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. It's unbelievable, because when you came in, games were tape delayed. The league had image problems with drugs. If I look at when David Stern came in and then where you left it on February 1st of 2014, I've always said, and I'm not just saying this because he's here, I've said this on the show before, this is the best commissioner in the history of sports.
That's right, why here. I come back.
No, but I mean, look at those numbers. That's
right.
Phenomenal.
The reality is, and I think this is what your students will learn, it's always a team effort. And
right.
I had the luxury when I was general counsel. Larry O'Brien was a great delegator. And so I had the luxury of being able to put together a team and probably hired the first 150 people. Myself, they sort of came through or did something. One gentleman named Billy Marshall, he was a buyer for Jordan Marsh, and I said, "You mean there's actually people that buy merchandise?" Because we were doing about $40 million a year. Now it's about $3 billion. And Billy was a buyer at Jordan Marsh in Boston. And he said, "Yes." I said, "Okay, well, how would you like to be the head of our merchandising division?" And he was. Brian McIntyre, mm-hmm. who was
PR.
Our PR head for a lot of years.
Yeah.
His claim to fame, I always kid him, he got, I say arrested, he said detained, because he was selling a competing game program outside of Chicago Stadium. I thought he was an entrepreneurial guy, and I brought him in. And that was it, everyone. Ed Desser, who was our head of broadcasting for 20 years, was with the Lakers and used to tell me what we were doing wrong. And I said, "Okay, wise ass, how would you like to come and do that?" So he got into his 280Z and came cross country, and he was the head of broadcasting for 20 years. So it was a lot of interesting people who we ran into along the way. Sooner or later, it got too big for me to do the hiring. I think when I stepped down in 2014, we were pushing 1,200 employees, but it was a great ride, and it was a team effort. After a while, I was learning more about management by what I didn't know than what I knew, because you have to learn how to delegate, you have to get good people around you, and you have to let them go and do whatever it is that they do well. So it was very much a team effort.
So Rick Welts, who's now the president of the Warriors and worked for you, so let me read this to you. This is a quote from him. "Back in the day when people had home telephones, you'd drag home, and inevitably, at exactly 10 o'clock at night, the phone would ring, and would be on the phone for 45 minutes. At 10 o'clock, it was Uncle David. And by the end of the call, you'd be ready to run through a wall the next day for the NBA.
That's an exaggeration. But,
but people
the reality
worked for you
was
for a long time.
A long time. I love when I get visited. I have an office on Fifth Avenue about six blocks up from the NBA, and it's... The only downside of its physical location is it's across the street from Trump Tower. So it's getting there.
First Trump reference.
Depending upon who's demonstrating on that day, it could be, so it's hard to walk around there. But people come up, and I always kid, because there's a receptionist there, and I say, "Oh, I fired this guy." You know, that's when Gary came up, or Rick Welts came up, or Scott O'Neill came up, or Val Ackerman, who's the commissioner of the Big East Conference.
Right, and was with the WNBA.
Before that, she started out life as my special assistant.
Wow.
And so there are a lot of alum mm-hmm. scattered. Chris Granger, I was just out at the opening of the Golden One Center, which is Sacramento's new building, which is beautiful. But he was the head of team marketing and business operations for the NBA, and now he's the president for business operations of the Sacramento Kings, and they're likely to sell out all year in a beautiful new arena. So there are a lot of people, and we all did this together. It was a very much a team effort, and we played off of each other in a very positive way, always deciding that we were going to do more the next time that same issue or event came around.
When we mentioned that we were going to have you as our guest for this show, everyone wants to know, hey, what's David Stern doing now? And I've done my research, but let's hear from you. What are you doing now?
Well, I am a senior advisor. That's a good phrase. I'm the CEO of DJS Global DJS Global Advisors. And I'm a senior advisor to the NBA. I'm a senior advisor to a very successful venture capital firm in New York, Graycroft Partners. I'm a senior advisor to the strategy group of PricewaterhouseCoopers. They do telecommunications, information communications, and entertainment, including sports. And I'm a senior advisor to PJT Partners, which is an investment bank headed up by Paul Taubman, the former president of, co-president of Morgan Stanley, and has a pretty big practice in sports and media-related things. I'm spending more time on NGOs that I had the opportunity to do. I'm on the board of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. I'm on the board of Jazz at Lincoln Center. I'm on the board of the Paley Center for Media.
Wow.
And on top of that, I'm advising four sports-related startups in the technology field, which is great fun.
Let's talk about those for a minute. So correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got LiveLike, which is a VR company.
LiveLike VR.
StatMuse.
StatMuse, which uses artificial intelligence to give you any answer to any sports-related question that you might have about leagues as they ingest the data. It's fascinating. I've had a demonstration from Alexa, the Amazon. Alexa is the voice. I'm forgetting what the name of the Amazon device is, but and is it the Hero?
Yeah.
Echo. Amazon Echo. Alexa, and it's chilling. Who has the most rebounds in a game in NBA history? And, people like me, it must be Chamberlain, it must be Dennis Rodman. It's Oakley.
Wow.
It's Oak. Can you imagine? I think it was like 39. I was like, okay, Alexa, don't, And then you ask your questions, and it's like, it's creepy, but great. And you can begin to see the use of artificial intelligence. LiveLike happens to be a VR solution, not quite the immersive of some others, but it was used for the Penn State Wisconsin game Saturday night by Fox Sports, and you can use it either with a headset or with your iPad to move it around. You have to be flexible. It's kind of interesting, and I think that's it's sort of a middle step to the having to put on a headset for a whole game. And the features at LiveLike are, it's going to ultimately have two avatars are in the suite with you. When you turn around, you don't see the arena, you see the suite, and there are screens in the suite for advertising. And ultimately, those avatars will represent two people who, through Wi-Fi, maybe Boingo, I don't know, through Wi-Fi, are watching the game with you. So you could have relatives in different parts of the world, and you could be watching the game with them. They're sort of, it's kind of neat. And there's a board where you can get the Twitter feed just like they're sitting behind us.
Isn't it amazing how, so we've got Boingo here, connectivity, and Doug always says it's like, connectivity at your arena is like having toilets for your fans. It's the same now.
It's so interesting the way. Well, all right, we'll talk about that. Let me mention the last two. I don't want to. I'll be in trouble.
Okay.
One is Fubo, which is a streaming service that has.
They're really growing.
Really growing, mostly soccer.
Yeah.
What you Americans call soccer, we call it football, but that's a whole other question. And it's about, I think it's pretty close to making an announcement about an expanded programming agenda. And
you want to break any news here?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
but I'm an advisor there, and it's really interesting. Fans find it. If you're a fan of soccer, the beautiful game, and you want to be at the Derby or El Clasico or whatever, you find your way to that. And I was interested in that because I just wanted to see where this streaming stuff was going. Call it over the top, call it whatever you want to call it, OTT. But it's upon us. And given what I thought was coming down the pike, which was Sling TV and
Apple TV.
Well, this is live streaming, so it's really going to be the what Disney was talking about in starting a streaming service for rights that it holds but doesn't exploit. What AT&T just launched last week, a $35 a month service that involves sports. And so you know, and I don't know anything about the NBA's current negotiations or anything, but I read in the newspaper last week that Amazon was looking for sports programming, obviously for a streaming service. Mm-hmm. And Facebook made a deal to stream NBA Development League games. So I sort of knew it was coming, and I wanted to be in and see how it goes. And it's really, really interesting, because together with the connectivity, you know, we've actually been doing it for years and years. People don't realize that, because NBA League Pass,
right,
which started out as just a direct TV and then a digital cable programming, had actually, when we went internet, well, we went domestically and globally, you can subscribe to NBA League Pass International on your smart device. So we've been streaming, in effect, I don't know how many, it may be as much as 8 or 10 years, I just can't remember, maybe it's 7 or 8 years.
So you guys were on the cutting edge.
No, well, we always tried everything, but now suddenly it dawned on me, and I guess I've been in Fubo, must be over a year, but I said, boy, if this works, this is going to be really interesting, and it is going to work, obviously, and it's not unrelated to, in my view, some of the issues that the NFL is having, mm-hmm, with decline, some of the issues that ESPN is having with the loss of subscribers. I mean, you know, when you
cord cutting,
well, yeah, or yes, but it's not so much a rejection of the sport, say I, as recognition of the ability that you can get it when you want it, and all of these new services, and I'm intellectually capable of understanding them, but I'm technologically disadvantaged by being able to actually do it. But they all have, you know, DVR capability, right, and, you know, and you can store it, you can run it, you can delay it, you can do anything you want to do to it. And you'll soon be doing incredible things with it. And finally, I'm an advisor to Shot Tracker, which is
Magic Johnson too, right?
Yes, Magic Johnson, right. He's a much bigger investor than I am. but it's really interesting. I've been out to their headquarters in Kansas City, and Shot Tracker is through, it's, you know, it's basically, it's a wearable devices. It's, you put a sensor in a little Gadugar on your sneaker, and you light up the gym, meaning you put a sensor on the ceiling of the gym, and they have an arrangement with Spalding where they have a sensor in a particular model of a Spalding ball. Now, it's kind of interesting because I'm learning about how you have to test the ball. It has to bounce within so many inches of the last time it bounced to be, you know, accepted. And the range of acceptability with the sensor is better than most balls without it. So they finally mastered that. And at that point, on your smart device or on the coach's iPad, you get real-time statistics. In other words, there's the screen in front of you, and you're watching the 10 players on the court. They're represented by little circles, and you can tell when the ball is passed, when the rebound is gotten, when the basket is made. And so it's going to lessen the role of student managers at practice, because in the big programs, like at the Big Ten, they're all charting shots. You've got an instant charting of shots. And it's all without cameras. So that's really going to, I think, change the world of statistical keeping. And, you know, it's going to be, and this is, I didn't get involved with what we think of as wearables, because it boggled my mind, but, you know, I just picture that day when the assistant coach is in a locker room someplace or a war room sending messages directly to another assistant coach on the bench saying, player X, his hydration is lousy, his heartbeat is too high, his lactic acid is congealing, his blood pressure is high, and the facial recognition tells me that he'd love to be any place but on the court right now. So it would be a good idea for you to replace him. And it sort of raised, I mean, maybe I'm not that interested because I'm trying not to think about it, because it makes it all robotic and takes sort of the spontaneity out of the game. But it's coming, because when you add to the analytics
right.
that have led up to it, so you can tell me what my PER is. What does PER stand for? Anyway,
per game.
I don't want to know. Okay, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, we're going to, it's actually indicative of what's happening in the world at large. Sports is really if I have a message, sports is the canary in the mine of globalization, of technology, of virtually every subject. Where does it get tried out in sports? So in looking at a number of startups that I have outside of the sports world, the data that is in the process of being collected about you poor people and me is it's remarkable. And we saw one yesterday that a bat company can tell you where the ball is hitting the bat. And so you can, do all kinds of good stuff. And it's really, and in terms of your shopping experience and why when you go someplace on the web to look up a particular product and suddenly you see offers coming in from unrelated places to sell you that same or a similar product, we're owned. And I think the same thing is, and a lot of it coming out of sports, I think, as well.
So when someone comes to David Stern and they say, I want you to invest in my company, what's the criteria that you're looking for? You've talked a lot about tech, but what are you looking for?
I send them to somebody else.
That person goes, David, you should invest in
them. No. I only invest in things that come in through Greycroft Partners. Either that they have made their own investment in, or that we've decided because of the stage of the company they won't be investing at this time, but I like it and invest personally. So, but that's it. It's all, I'm laughing because when it was announced that there was a round in Shot Tracker, mm-hmm. and they quoted Magic and they quoted me, the next day, that weekend, my mailbox filled up with proposals. Oh, no, this can't be. And the same thing happened when I guess there was Forbes did a story on StatMuse, and I gave a quote. Or maybe it was Lifelike. I can't remember which one. Or maybe it was Shot. I can't remember. And the next thing I know, Forbes says, would you like to come to our 30... under 30 conference in Boston. I said, what does that have to do with me? and they said, well, you'll be with Richard Branson and Ashton Kutcher and Jim Breyer, all these well-known. I said, this would be proving the concept that you can't fool all of the people all of the time, or maybe you can. But I actually went up and did a panel, and it was fun. And because the beauty, to me, the beauty of sports, at least through my career, and the beauty of life in many ways, is you can be a continual student. Mm-hmm. There's always something to learn. And being around young, vibrant, lively venture capitalists who speak in a tongue that is so foreign to me that it was frightening. It's taken me 2 years to learn all the acronyms that spin off their... And they're meaningful acronyms, and they're easy enough. At one point I said, stop. If you give me your SDK, I'll give you my API, and I'll trade you for your MRR, and you give me your CAC, and you give me your AECV. What are you guys talking about? And they said, okay, we'll explain it to you. So I'm a slow learner, but I'm a learner, And it's been great to have to learn that. And it's been great to learn something about investment banking as well. And in terms of the strategy group of PricewaterhouseCoopers, which only does about $12 billion a year in advisory strategy fees, it's great to just sit there and learn about the scope and what companies do and the like on a global basis. And I'm probably, for all of the above reasons and more, I'm going to run out to the Consumer Electronics Show along with 180,000 of my closest friends, I suppose, in Las Vegas in the first week in January, and just to keep learning more. And even that show, which started out as electronic products, now is turning into an auto show to some degree because of autonomous driving or whatever you call it, driverless cars. So it's all connected, and in some ways it's connected through sports.
We're going to open it up to questions in a little bit, so get your questions ready. But I want to cover a few kind of quick-hitting topics with you. So the NBA-CBA, both sides can opt out December 15th. I know you're only a senior advisor. You're not sitting at the table. But give me an idea, and us, an idea of, as the commissioner, you work for the owners, but you're also trying to maintain good relationship with the players. What is that dynamic like as you're trying to reach a new agreement?
I think you're almost on the same side. Nobody wants to opt out. The amount of money coursing through the veins of the league is extraordinary. And that has a wonderful, wonderful effect of calming things down. And what I read in the newspapers is they're getting close to a deal, and I can understand why. And I really think there is a shared interest. We've had some issues in the past. I think it was at a different stage in our development, and it was a different relationship with the union. But I think Michelle Roberts, the head of the union, is interested in her players. Mm-hmm. And I think Adam Silver, the commissioner, is interested in his owners and his players, and so I think they're gonna do fine, and I think it's wonderful that they're developing a close relationship.
In the NFL right now, the Rams recently moved from St. Louis to Los Angeles. There are reports that the Chargers may move from San Diego to Los Angeles. We're seeing relocations. In the NBA, I credit you with saving Sacramento and saving New Orleans. I mean, you really fought for those teams. You were just in Sacramento. They named a street after you there,
yeah,
for heck's sake. So here's my question to you. These leagues, the NFL generates $12 billion a year.
Right.
Instead of having a team move, like the Chargers, why wouldn't you, as the league, loan that team money, play the bank, to build a $900 million venue and keep the team in that city? It's not like the olden days where these leagues didn't have tons of money.
No.
I don't think it's good when we see relocation, and I think I
can't take credit because, honestly, enough teams have moved on my watch that, I don't come here with clean hands. I mean, we had, I don't know whether, remember, the Sacramento Kings started out as the Rochester Royals, and then they became the Kansas City Kings. Then they became the Kansas City Omaha Kings. Then they became the Sacramento Kings. Does anybody think that there's much jazz in Utah?
Well, I was wondering about that.
That was the New Orleans Jazz. And actually, think about it. There aren't that many lakes in L.A., but the Minneapolis Lakers moved to L.A.,
That wasn't on your watch.
No, that was a long time ago. But that was the first sort of team out west. The New Jersey Nets.
Seattle's the one that probably...
Well, the Nets don't count. They moved from Long Island. That's right. They played in the Armory under a gentleman by the name of Arthur Brown in Teaneck, New Jersey. The New Jersey Nets.
So can the leagues play bank?
No, I don't think they can help, but there has to be an essential accommodation between the team and the city. And my concern always was that I always believe that it's most of the time it's about management. I think that the New Orleans team was, you know, it wasn't being managed at the highest possible level, and the owner was flailing a bit, and I made the mistake of saying to the owners, maybe we should buy it in. And they said yes. They made the mistake of saying yes. So for a year, the NBA owned the team, and then we were able to sell it to the best buyer in the market, Tom Benson, who also owns the Saints, and
right.
They're sort of co-located in this one place. And we made a deal with the state, which was very generous to keep the team there. And so we assured that it's there, because I thought that the fans who had supported it there deserved a better shot. In Sacramento, we had the best fans over the years. They were totally nuts. Anyone that could upset Phil Jackson by ringing cowbells, you got to like them. And in good fun. But the team just was in a spiral downward. The city stepped up with an imaginative financing plan led by Kevin Johnson, and our NBA owner said, okay, let's keep it there. And to me, at least, if your fans support you and you're doing very well, you should owe them a shot, however you try to work it out, of keeping a team there. That's all.
Do you think we'll see a team back in Seattle? I'm in Portland. A lot of people love that rivalry. They're loud up there.
I'll give you Commissioner Silver's phone.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that was a tough one, I'm sure.
Well,
and they don't always work out.
No, they don't. But there was I went out there while the team was there and testified in the State House.
Yep.
And someone suggested that if they needed to build a building, the players should take a cut in salary. I didn't think that was going to work that well.
I've never seen that happen.
Yeah, and I didn't think it should happen. And so they looked at a lot of different options, but then when they ran out of options, they moved, and the NBA owners approved it. And I think that the dynamics of the leagues have changed. If you expand by issuing another franchise, every team takes a cut in its collective revenues, takes a drop. So you share with them your network television, you share with them your licensing revenue, you share with them your international revenues and the like. And all of a sudden, those amounts have gotten sufficiently large that it's a pretty large, it really takes the price of an expansion franchise really up high. And in some owners think that all you're doing is substituting. It's almost like a loan. You take $1 billion in, and over a period of years for a franchise, you pay it back to that team by virtue of the cut in network television revenues, licensing revenues, and international revenues. So it's going to be an interesting issue to see what happens with expansion all around.
We are seeing athletes in all sports, coaches as well, speak up on social issues. I would say more so in the last 6 to 12 months than I can remember seeing, other than back to the days of Muhammad Ali, Arthur Ashe, people like that. They're sticking their necks out there a little bit more. I mean, let's face it, Michael Jordan didn't really stick his neck out there. Tiger Woods, what do you think about this?
I think that it's too easy to group it. You know, Bill Russell was there on the Mall in Washington with Dr. King. Okay, so the NBA has a rich history of players being involved. And we've always encouraged our players to speak out. I think that, and we've given them, I mean, this enormous platform.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we do with players nowadays is assist them in getting on social media. You know, it used to be something new, but now it's great. We're here at the offices of the Player Tribune, which is one way for players to do it. There's the, what's it called? The undefeated, the interrupted, the uninterrupted. You know, you name it, there are different. You can be out every place. And then when you have the players, and they not only have their social media I remember, I guess, which I can't remember which Olympics it was when Instagram was relatively new, and we, you know, our players were photographing each other sleeping on the plane or something like that. You know, but it was great. It was great, and you knew where it was going because, and that's great. And now players are interviewed pre-game, they're interviewed post-game, so the platform is there, and they should speak out. And we've always encouraged it. I recognize it's happening more now, and that's a good thing. And it should happen in good ways. Players should use their voice. They're celebrity citizens, and it gives me a source of great pride because when, in the early days, the reputation of, quote, the average NBA player weighed down by a lot of unfortunate incidents was not very high. I used to say their reputation was in the buried under the pyramid, but now their reputations, appropriately so, are at the top of the pyramid.
Right.
And so these are celebrities that have a great voice, and why not?
So with all this tech and connectivity, are we ever going to see you on social media?
You know, there were a lot of fake David Sterns.
Oh, yeah, there were a lot.
While I was commissioner, and it used to, you know, make me a little nervous. So I shied away. You may not see me, but I'll be watching in other ways, in shape and form. But I'm not sure my battered body could take the assault that would come if I were identified as being on social media. So I'm not planning to be.
Gambling and gaming. You said recently the notion that that's going to lead to bad things has gotten to be an outdated notion as we learn more about illegal gaming and the size of the market.
Yeah. I think it's time to legalize sports betting. And my view on that changed dramatically when fantasy sports, daily fantasy came. Mm-hmm. So what is, no, that's not betting. And then there's this argument, is it betting, is it not betting? It is what it is, and it's a way you can make money. You know, I actually thought it wasn't gambling, but everyone else, because if 3% of the players win 90% of the money, that sounds to me like a game of skill. But it had enough of a gambling component to it that it attracted people who thought they were gambling and thought they had a fair shot, even if they didn't. And so I said, I threw up my hands. And then you hear all of these stats that there's $4 billion bet in Las Vegas and there's $100 billion bet that is bet with organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so given the fact that the states are all looking for revenue sources and the federal government is too, and lotteries are the worst bet there is. In other words, everyone in this room right now, having not bought a lottery ticket, statistically has about the same chance to win the lottery as if one of us went out and bought a lottery ticket. That's how stacked the odds are. And people are encouraged to bet their money, their grocery money, to help education or senior citizen housing. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, and there was a time, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, that lotteries were illegal. It was a long time ago, you know, back in the in pre-flood days. But so I just think, and I'm not worried about the, there's no more risk of, there's no more risk of fixes or anything than there, than, you know, than there is now. In my own view, I had moved my opposition to sports betting to that argument that said most of our fans are not point spread fans. They go to a game and they want to see the home team win. And the notion that they left the arena unhappy because the home team won but didn't cover was sort of, I thought, would change the nature of the game. But given fantasy now where people aren't even watching games, they're watching to see how their player did and the like, I think it's, you know, sports will adapt. We'll have the right enforcement mechanisms. They'll find a good way to use the betting that happens to drive ratings and interest in the game, because what's happening now is people, I think, go to, not me, of course, but they go to places and they make proposition bets. And you, the proposition bet is when you go to the line for two shots in the fourth period, someone's going to lay you odds on what the likelihood is. You're going to make one, make both, make the first, make the second. And around the world, the same is happening and has been happening with soccer, where you can place bets in the stadium. So, you know, let's get over it and move on to the next phase of our relationship with sports betting.
Last question before we open it up to the audience. You're an advisor to the NBA, but I'm sure you pay attention to sports in general. If I gave you a golden ticket, and as a sports fan, you could change anything in sports right now, what would it be? Is there anything that you sit and you go, God, I can't believe that's going on?
I think there... Yeah, no. The audience member yelled, the Knicks win a championship. No, you know, I think that where we're heading, and this is very important, is using technology and other advances, including scheduling, to reduce injury. Because to go to a game and not see a particular player because he's been worn down or injured or the like, and I read in the morning papers that it seems like the parties are negotiating in the NBA about starting the season earlier.
Right.
Playing fewer exhibition games, cutting down on a number of back-to-backs. You'll begin, I think, to see fresher players playing. And I think that's a good thing. To me, it's just injuries. And to think that we used to watch football games and cheer because the quarterback had his bell rung.
Right.
Think about that. We're gonna regret that for a long time as players get injured in games. That's the thing that, to me, that deprives the fans of the full value of their fandom.
We've got students here from the Marist Center for Sports Communications. We have students from Columbia University. We've got a microphone right here. Raise your hand if you'd like to ask David Stern a question. Please identify yourself with your name and your school. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Maurice Eisman from Columbia University Sports Management Program. So we've seen a trend coming that teams from Philadelphia, from Houston, have started to invest or look at investments in esports. What is your view on that sport in particular, and what do you think is the value that the NBA or NBA teams can bring to it, and vice versa?
Well, I saw, you know, yes, there are teams in the NBA and elsewhere that are investing in esports team. I've said before, it sort of, it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck. It's probably a duck, and these guys look like real teams and real leagues potential. It might not, it may be my poor upbringing, but the idea of going into an arena with 20,000 fans to watching 10 people in glass booths with fast twitches playing video games, it's not in my cultural background, but it is in a lot of people's backgrounds as we change generations. So that's kind of interesting to me. So I think we'll have to see. I don't know that it televises spectacularly. I think Turner was televising it on TBS on the nights of the NBA finals, yeah. I think. So I was able to catch a couple. I think maybe it was a Sunday night and the game ended earlier or something like that. So, and I couldn't get used to it or warm up to it, watching someone peek around the corner and getting shot. But, you know, I think that it's going to bring a whole nother generation, a different kind of generation, into sports. And that's a good thing, and it will fill up arenas at probably a different price point with a younger audience. People love competition. And if you like esports, I'd like to sell you a drone racing franchise. That's next. No, I'm kidding. It's actually the drone racing. You know, my God, where we are, going to the arena. I just would like to be either the lawyer or the insurance company when those drones start to have some issues. But it's coming. We're looking for everything, in case nobody's watching it. rugby sevens, rugby's 11s, rugby's whatever. I saw something called fight ball, which is what it sounds like, basketball. You have to, you know, there's an Indian sport called kabaddi, which is some combination of rugby and wrestling, you know, and people are deciding that if it's sports and it's live, it's something that you should have on television. And that's an interesting outcome, and I think esports is right up there. I mean, the concept that it's kind of interesting. You hire a team, you put them in a dormitory, you feed them, you make them work out. They have to play video games for 8 hours a day to make sure their Twitch is fast enough. Wow. It's not my thing, but I could understand that it could be a thing. I know that there's a new league being formed by Activision Blizzard. They haven't contacted me yet to be commissioner.
But, are you up for that job?
I'm not available.
No.
But I think it's an interesting idea. I really do, and I think it will, you know... Maybe they can combine it with drone racing. Once you rent the arena, you could have drone racing as a preliminary or afterwards.
Other questions?
Yeah, my name is TJ Winfrey from Columbia Business School. Question for you. So you're the commissioner who was credited for ushering in globalization basketball. Given the NBA's recent investment, where do you see the next frontier? Comment on the NBA's earnings
internationally. Sure. That's easy. I mean, on my last May, I was in office. I went to Mumbai. We had an office that I opened up there. We were being shown there by Sony 6, I think, is the entertainment network, which also had the, I guess it's the IPL, the Indian Premier League, which was 2020 cricket. You know, short cricket shortened from 5 days to 3 hours. And we went to a game there at 40,000 people. And I walked in, I thought a basketball game was about to take place. There were lots of noise, lots of video, lots of blaring music, lots of cheerleaders, lots of fog. Smoke, you know, blowing out there. And I was interviewed both on the international feed and the domestic feed, shamelessly hawking the NBA, which gets 80,000 viewers a game, and the Indian Premier League gets 10 million. Wow. So you could see there's a delta there that's yet to be filled. But good, because it's happening, and it will continue to happen as new generations are introduced to basketball. Basketball is a great sport. It doesn't need a lot to get started. We've had a number of players. Most recently, I think Sean Marion is there for the NBA. We had, I think, Kevin Durant was there. AC Green was there. We've done a lot over there. Vivek Ranadive, and Raj Bathal are two owners of Sacramento who are born in India. And so it's going to be huge, I think. And it's going to take some time, but remember, we have lots of time. I made the deal with China Central Television in 1990, you know, and gave them our games, gave away our games so they would play them. But now it's a huge market for the NBA. It's a huge market for everyone. And so I think that there's no market that is not a good potential market for the NBA. Latin America, the NBA's offices in, I think, Mexico, Argentina, and Brazil. Maybe not Argentina. We're in Europe. Headquarters are in London. I'm going to go to the game there between Denver and Indiana in January. It's just the world is our oyster. I think that, and I don't know that. That doesn't mean necessarily teams being located there. I think it's easier for the NFL because they can play one game a week. For us, I've always said that it's within the next 10 years. I've been saying that for 30 years.
You said last time.
Yeah, that's what I said last time, right? That's what I always say. It's good. And now I think Adam will pick it up. You'll say, another 10 years. But because we need more, we could have a, we need a five-team division. We need arenas. We need fan avidity to be at the right level. We need a financial plan. We need a television plan. But it's interesting. But there's much you can do without it. You know, we don't have a franchise in China, but we've played exhibitions there since 2004. And look what's happened there. The first time we went into Shanghai, the arena we put in, it was a great arena. All we had to add was the floor, the baskets, the lighting, the locker rooms, and some seating. Now there's this beautiful 20,000-seat Mercedes-Benz arena. Same, and there's another arena like a mile down the road that the city of Shanghai put in. And so we played a practice there and a game in the Mercedes-Benz arena. So, and it's happening all over. And I think in India, the interesting thing is whether, you know, there's a young man named Satnam Singh who was drafted, put in the D-League, I don't know where he is. And there were a couple of Indian players on, I think, New Mexico State a couple of years back. And I've just... It'll happen, and it will continue to grow. The beauty of being global is you don't feel enormous pressure on any one market. You just keep making the deals. So now NBA basketball is seen in over 200 countries and territories in 43 different languages, and you could follow up with streaming games, with social media activity. I think the activity of the NBA, I'm not sure, but I bet you it's about half is outside the United States. So this is such an enormous opportunity. And for our players, because we have so many players that travel with respect to their endorsements and other things, or we travel them. So I think it's just a win-win all around.
More questions?
Hi, how you doing? I'm Mark Rashan from Marist College, and you talked a little bit about the NBA ownership of the New Orleans franchise. I was wondering, the biggest decision you had was the cancellation of the Chris Paul trade to the Los Angeles Lakers.
As we speak, I'm in an argument with somebody who writes for ESPN, because I'm going to correct your language. What cancellation? the GM was not authorized to make that trade, and acting on behalf of owners, we decided not to make it. I was an owner rep, so it wasn't. There was nothing to void. It just never got made. But when you're the commissioner, and you have two teams that are ticked off at you, as in the Lakers and Houston, and the GMs, without being wanting to be attributed, spend their time trashing you, the wrong impression can be granted. And one of the few times I decided to just go radio silent and let it play out, I got killed. But that's, so the answer is, there was never a trade. It wasn't approved by me as the owner rep.
All right, could I ask a different question?
Sure.
What would you say
Mayhurst,
to...
So that's it? Okay. I got it.
What would you say to a commissioner in like the MLS and a growing league like that, and you came into the NBA while it was growing and you grew that sport, that league to what it is today? What would you say to a growing league like the MLS to expand?
I think Don Garber's doing a great job. They have a different, every league has its own approach. They're delivering these very soccer-specific stadiums, and they're 20,000 seats. They look great, and I think that's the right way to go. They're going to get fans into them, especially as the nature of this country, the demographic makeup changes. You have to speak, 178 languages to appreciate a soccer game, and that's wonderful. That's great. I think the challenge is going to be the fight for TV ratings. That's where the big bucks have been. But even then, as their deals expire, the streaming capacity, if you want to make deals with, someone was showing me their beIN Sport streaming, which is, has a lot of soccer on it, or Goal, or Univision. Deportes or the like. So I think they will probably have to do some new mining of how to pick up more revenue there, but they're all over it, and I think he's doing a great job. I really do.
Other questions?
Hey there. Oh, that's loud. Hey there, Mr. Stern. My name is Billy Floyd from Marist College, and in 2006, you guys made a change to the design of the game basketball. What was the reasoning behind that change, and were there any specific players that complained about it the most?
I didn't plant these questions, by the way.
No, that's okay. I think we changed. It wasn't the design of the ball so much as the material of the ball. We went to a synthetic. I think that's what you're referring to. And then the players said it cut their hands, and et cetera, et cetera. Now I can say it. I didn't even know we were doing it. That's what a great micromanager I was.
Uh-huh.
A ball is a ball. What's the big deal? And I think if you go buy an official game ball, that's the ball you're going to buy, and that's what everyone uses, but not our players. We said to Spalding, it's not worth it. Just go back to producing the balls exactly as it is, because we don't want it to affect the competitive nature of the game, real or imagined, which it could be. And so that's what happened. And, I get a kick out of this subject because when we were forming the WNBA, of course, no one here asked about the W, we had a big argument internally about whether we should use a different kind of a ball. So number one, we used a smaller ball, which is not uncommon. And number two, our big fight was whether we should go with what we eventually went with, which was the oatmeal and white ball, as opposed to just an orange or a brown ball. And the women who were driving it were very protective of the fact that they wanted to have a ball that looked just like the men's ball. Hmm. And I said, we'll never sell any, and it won't be distinctive. And so I'm overruling you. We're going to make this a ball that looks different to signify the W, and that's what it's going to stand for. In the intervening years, FIBA, the International Basketball Federation, has gone to a two-color ball the same way. Now it's like all over. They copied the WNBA into what the official ball is for leagues around the world. So the ball does have consequences, and it does stand for things. And you're right, we probably didn't handle that exactly as well as we should have in terms of that particular change.
By the way, Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, and this year, the FIBA Hall of Fame.
Right.
Let's give a round of applause for that. That's pretty good. A few more questions from the students. Go ahead.
Hi, Commissioner Stern, Ryan Berger. I was up at the NBA PA's new facility yesterday. It's incredible. Not a lot of people know what's sort of going on with the players and what Michelle is doing with the change of how they're unionizing. Not only the ability to obviously do the deal, but no one talks about what's going to happen after the deal if the players get what they're looking for. It feels like they're sort of building a little bit of a media company themselves. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you think of, if the deal happens, what's going to happen after that? What will the players, how will brands be able to approach players as a union versus individual players?
That's an interesting question. I good luck to them. I mean, it's hard work. We started with nothing, and we struggled to build around our ability to promote the game and the players. The players, how do I say this? We actually owned the group rights from the players, and we paid a minimum. And we never, in the early years, we never hit the minimum. In other words, we paid them, whether it was $20 or $25 million a year. And we wound up against the percentage of the royalties, but we never really sold enough to make that. But now I think the union believes that it can do better. And because of changes in social media and the like, maybe they can, and delivery, et cetera. I was concerned that I wanted to speak to the marketplace with a single voice, because that was the best way to make this into a brand. I had inadvertently become a brand manager, which is, I think, what all commissioners are, in addition to everything else they do. But now there may be so many more opportunities that additional activities are not going to be dilutive, but may be reinforcing of the overall branding of the NBA. And that's why something like the Players Tribune or the, you know, or other ways that the players reach out is actually good for business. We've never, over the last decade or so, we always wanted to have the most distributed content. Some of the leagues were sort of looking inward and blocking things, but that was never our way, and that was never Commissioner Silver's way. He was always a proponent of widely distributed content. So this may just be, we may be looking at more of the same. I've been invited over to play basketball on the court, but I want my partial knee replacement to settle in before I do that, you know, and so, you know, I have a good relationship with several of the people over there.
You might have played better D on Klay Thompson than the Pacers did last night.
I would have fouled them like crazy. I mean, you know, I hate to sound like Charles, but gee, we got to whack that. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Charles would say something politically incorrect. I'm positive. Otherwise, he wouldn't be Charles. But, I mean, he would probably say, how did you let that guy take so many shots? But I guess the game was out of control anyway, so it was
couple more questions from the students.
How you doing, Mr. Stern? My name is Sam Partis. I go to Marist College. One of the greatest debated questions in NBA between fans is LeBron and Jordan. Can you talk about the differences, how they impacted the NBA, and also, if you had a Game 7 NBA Finals, who are you taking?
I'm not going to answer. I'm just not going to answer, other than it is a great question, and they're really different. LeBron is the most superb athlete that I've seen created. Michael was the most superb competitor that I've ever been around. Whether you were his teammate or the opposition, if you stood in the way of him winning, you better get out of the way. And they are both, you know, Hall of Famers at the top of the game, but I'm not going beyond that.
One more question.
Hi, my name is Tanya from Columbia University also. So we've been talking a lot about social media, technology. Obviously, ESPN has increased their numbers. So how do you see this affecting, like, stadium attendance and the future, like TV rights? What are your thoughts on that?
I think, you know, one of the things we always wanted to talk about internally was at the NBA was everything should drive focus on the game experience. There are some of us sort of quasi-old-timers that actually like to hear the sneakers squeaking on the court. And a lot of the other things are distractions. But nevertheless, the entertainment experience in the arena, it's really, I used to say that when everyone stays in their homes in this future dystopian society, where they order their pizza in the house, they get their EKG taken electronically, they order their automobile delivered to the front door, the two places where they're still going to congregate are houses of worship and houses of sports worship. And we believe that, and that's what we're going to continue to do. I think that, you know, I get it. You know, if it's February and it's snowing, or maybe if it's January and it's snowing, you know, maybe it's easier to watch the game by the fire on your 78-inch Samsung HD, HDR, surround shaped, Dolby assisted, you know, with the floor shaking if the fans are, you know, I got in a car and it was equipped with something that if you start to cross the lane without your blinker on,
the wheel starts to rumble, and there's another one where the seatbelt starts to tighten. So I can imagine fans ultimately strapping themselves in at home and holding on to something so they can experience it. But still, there's nothing like being at the game. And I'm in all deference to the Wi-Fi that's going to be there. You know, I think fans demand it. They may want to see their own highlights, etc., take their own photos, communicate with their friends. But then they're going to miss a lot of the action. So there's a balance that's going to have to be adjusted along the way. I think the game experience. The only thing that you can fear as a threat to the game experience is pricing, where people reach a point and say no. And then the leagues will have to wrestle with the question of how they do the adjustments to make sure that the studio is full, because playing in an empty arena is not conducive to the players playing well. I always said, you know, guys, it isn't just about the attendance. If your players are there and it's a 20,000-seat building and you've got 8,500 people in the building, that's not as inspiring as whether they're all fans shouting their, you know, themselves silly. And it is a communal experience. Where else can you come together with 20,000 strangers and join in the experience of rooting collectively the home team to victory? It's a really nice cultural aspect that we don't focus on that much. And the one thing else that we didn't focus on, now that the questions are over, is we did touch briefly on players speaking out, but the ability of sports to influence social issues is enormous. Underappreciated in some way because it happens so naturally. But literally the debate about HIV in this country was changed by Magic Johnson. Reactions to players being, you know, assumed guilty when someone comes forward, and then learning about due process where the prosecution didn't go forward or was dropped. That's a lesson in itself. There have been many lessons that sports has to teach, and it's important that our players, as they unleash this new found power that they have, speak on issues of some importance. I don't want to put the discussion too much off track, but you know, there are still 16 million kids who go to sleep hungry every night. And the NBA works with an outfit called Share Our Strength, another one called Second Harvest. Our players do too. And we're going to have to begin to see that have an impact, because there are just too many imperfect things in this world that athletes have the opportunity, and I would say the obligation, together with their teams and leagues, to speak out on, that are relatively non-controversial, but just don't show us in such a great light as we purport to lecture the world on how it should behave. We should worry about how to behave, and our players and our teams have an extraordinary opportunity, and I would say obligation, to speak out on those things.
You're on the Council for Foreign Relations. Will we ever see you run for office? I know people were like trying to get you to run for mayor.
No, not going to happen.
No.
There's a signed pledge in the drawer back in my home. You know, if it were going to happen, it would happen 20 years ago, but it's not happening.
Let's give a big round of applause to David Stern. Thank you, David. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Sports Business Radio host Brian Berger here. The wait is finally over. Sports Business Radio merchandise has finally arrived. We're working with our friends at the Parish Project to provide you with the opportunity to buy really quality Sports Business Radio merchandise. We've started with long sleeve t-shirts and short sleeve t-shirts. They come in 5 different colors each, a variety of sizes. I love my shirts. And soon we're going to have hoodies to offer as well, hooded sweatshirts. I know a lot of you are wearing hooded sweatshirts while you're working from home these days, but whether you're working out, just lounging around the house, or doing whatever you're doing, you can rock Sports Business Radio merchandise. I think you're going to love it. Go to parishproject.com. That's P-A-R-I-S-H project.com. Parishproject.com.
and you can order your Sports Business Radio merchandise today. We appreciate your support, and send us your best picture. Tweet it to us at SB Radio, or also you can get us on Instagram at Sports Business Radio. We look forward to seeing you rocking that Sports Business Radio merchandise. Well, that's it for this edition of Sports Business Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to our show staff, Brian Griggs and Josh Blank. And thanks to our partner, Malka Sports, for powering Sports Business Radio. Learn more about them online at malkasports.com. That's M-A-L-K-A sports.com. For Brian Griggs, I'm Brian Berger. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon right here on Sports Business Radio.
This and every SBR podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and your favorite listening app. Follow Sports Business Radio on Facebook, Twitter at SB Radio, Instagram at Sports Business Radio, and online at sportsbusinessradio.com. Sports Business Radio is produced by Brian Griggs and Griggs Productions, griggsproductions.com.